I'm Tiziana Deering, and welcome to a special hour of Radio Boston. Today we're marking Labor Day, a day set up to pay tribute to American workers in the labor movement, and also the unofficial end of summer, a time when folks all across Massachusetts gather, most vaxxed en masse this year, for that final sunny hooray before the yellow buses come for most kids and before pumpkin spice flavoring is truly unavoidable. For a lot of us, that last summer shebang involves food, lots of it. So this hour on Radio Boston, we wanted to bring you three recent conversations about food, particularly food we enjoyed during this pandemic. We talk a lot about food on this show, from the love of seafood back in July when Chris Siderick spoke with Maine-based author Barton Seaver, author of The Joy of Seafood.
There's no ingredient category that's more compelling to me than seafood, just all of its seasonality, tastes, textures, colors, aromas, the narratives behind it. I mean, what other food comes with sort of the expectation of tall tales surrounding its origins, and how it came to us? It's just a fascinating thing to cook. I mean, that's what it is to me, the joy of an ever-changing, always delicious ingredient.
Or maybe your jam is sandwiches.
I mean, I'm a sandwich freak. Like, get a restraining order, you know, because I love the sandwich. And I actually just spent a couple weeks doing a sandwich. I was making bacon from scratch. So I made 5 pounds of homemade espresso chipotle bacon and then made a BLT from scratch. So I made a mayo, I made the bread, I made the bacon, and I have to say it was worth all that time.
I think I've been revisiting the opposite, the peanut butter and jelly. I was at a farmer's market and picked up this incredible jar of Concord grape jelly from Grateful Jams, and it was, you know, the pinnacle of all Concord grape jelly, so I had to make a PB&J with it.
Irene Lee of Maymay Group and local chef Joe Gatto there speaking with Jamie Bologna last month. But those conversations are available on our website, radioboston.org. For our first segment today, we turn to the grill and a call-in segment we did before Memorial Day about getting back out there and firing up some food with friends and family. Our guests, the indefatigable Joe Gatto and Cheryl Strotter, chef and owner of Soleil in Nubian Square. We began with the question every radio conversation about grilling should start with. What is it about the grill that just makes us all so happy?
There is something that is really cool when you put fire to food and you get that charcoal or smoky taste that's infused in whatever is on your grill.
All right, so that gives me a chance to say, okay, Joe, you are the from scratch guy. You have actually made charcoal on your show. So picking up on what Cheryl just said, what is the key to a good charcoal for getting that smokiness and the right flavor into whatever's on the grill?
I mean, the big thing for me when I'm on the grill is you want to get those coals super hot. You want to make sure they're white and really, really hot, where you can't really hold your hand too long over those coals because, you know, you're really looking for that heat for caramelization, which is the key to everything, so we can get that beautiful sear. If we're cooking too early, we don't want that to happen because we're not going to get that browning happening and that caramelization and that yumminess. So definitely get your grill hot. That's a big, big thing.
And Cheryl, are you an agnostic on the ancient battle of gas versus charcoal? Or do you have a preference?
I actually have both at my house. It depends on the flavor that I want in the protein that I'm cooking, or actually the vegetable that I'm cooking. So I enjoy using both methods. And as was shared, it must be hot, whether it's the charcoal or the gas. I'm a big fan of marinating items, but I do like both.
Let's talk about veggies that grill well. Joe.
I'm a big bok choy fan. I just think that's such
I was
a
not expecting the first vegetable to be bok choy. Yeah, sorry, you threw me.
Out of the gate, you know, I like to throw a little curveball. So, you know, I just love how that grills up with those beautiful grill marks and you're getting that nice browning. It's just a delicious vegetable to throw on there and it always surprises people. So, you know, that I think that's a great one to start with.
And what else?
Oh, I mean corn. You know, you got to go corn.
And how? How do you do corn without burning it? How do you do it without burning it?
You know, you want to get a little char on that corn. So what I do to cut down time when, you know, we're cooking for the family or having a big epic barbecue doing something like that, you know, I boil it beforehand just to cook it, and then I finish it on the grill, and you want that char on there, you know? You want to get that beautiful char to get those flavors so it's getting nice and complex, because the sugars in the corn are going to just slightly char and burn and brown, and it's going to be all different flavors and textures through the whole corn, you know, and the whole cob. So, yeah, corn's a big, huge one. And then you can make a nice little, you know, garlic butter or something that like that for the table, which people will slather all over it and shove in their pie hole.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I'm assuming then, unshucked, no foil, nothing, straight on the grill.
Yeah, I go straight on the grill.
Straight on, that's right. Cheryl, how about you and vegetables? We, you know, we have a lot of vegetarians out there who want to be able to enjoy the grilling, and there's so much great stuff you can put on a grill.
There is. If you cut the vegetables lengthwise, let's say, for example, zucchini or yellow squash, that grills nicely. You could always do the circular cut for eggplant. But I also like sweet potatoes on a grill as well. Mm. So anything veggie and firm works for me on a grill.
So with sweet potatoes, I'm curious about this. Do you, you know, bake them first and finish them on a grill, kind of the way Joe said he boils the corn and then finishes it on the grill? Or do you do that potato on the grill from beginning to end?
I started out with some water to get it a little tender. Really, you don't want it too soft. You want it a little firm so it will stand up on the grill. But I do put it in the water, some seasoning, and then put it on the grill with some cinnamon and brown sugar. Amazing. Mm.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I love grilling all the time. Whether, you know, whatever it is, I'm out there. I like getting the fire started. I like being out back. I just love the whole grilling experience.
And do you grill something different when it's chillier than if it's, you know, 90 degrees out?
You know, it's really just like whatever I have, I'm grilling. So it could be salmon. You know, it could be filet. It could just be, you know, we do tamales at the house a lot, and those finish beautifully on the grill because you can get a little smoke on them. So anything I can throw on fire, I'm throwing on fire.
And Cheryl, we had you on the show recently to talk about Soleil and the vibe that you have missed. And that's really stuck with me. So what is the vibe of the barbecue? And what are you most looking forward to getting back to with that?
I think the vibe around barbecue is everybody getting together. We have been so separated for the past year. And the vibe with food, it's a common thread that we all have. We all eat whatever our culture is. So I miss the excitement and the joy and the stories and the fun and the laughter. That's the vibe that I look for when I'm grilling.
We've got Dave on the line in Orleans. Tell us about grilling, Dave. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to mention the portabellas.
How do you cook them, Dave?
Well, my girlfriend likes to get them with the soy sauce, so you just fill them up like a little bowl with some soy sauce, a little fish sauce, and then, you know, a little S&P. Put them right on the grill, and it just steams up. I was like, okay, you know, I'm not a portobello guy, but I was blown away.
That does sound delicious. Joe Gatto, is that the prime way to cook portobellos on the grill?
Yeah, I was wondering what time he was going to invite me over. You know, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, we're doing them tonight.
Okay.
Say that again, Dave. You're doing them tonight?
Work for you?
we grill every night. You got to grill early and often.
Amen to that.
Absolutely.
So, okay, but to that point, what if about our listeners, Cheryl, who don't have a grill, can't grill outside? How do you get some of that grill feel cooking indoors? You know, you use a skillet? Do you fire up the George Foreman? You know, how do you do that?
So there are some pans that are perforated, and you get those ridges that will give that grill look. So let's say, for example, I want to have some salmon. A neat way to do salmon is to marinate it. And a marinade, a real quick one, is an acid, an oil, and an herb. So, for example, you could mix lemon juice, lemon rind with an oil and some fresh herbs. Let your salmon sit in that for a little while and put it on a hot perforated pan, and it will look like it was grilled.
That sounds fantastic, but I did notice that you said look. You did not say taste. Well,
it will taste. It will still taste, you know, as if it were cooked inside. It will look and give the appearance of being grilled. You can make a smoker in your house. You know, I don't know how much people want to get into foil and wood chips and things like that in their home, but you can actually make a small version of a smoker on your stove.
Joe Gatto, Marquise in our studio wants to know about a good mix for some spicy wings. What do you got?
I mean, spicy wings, I'm a big believer in like a dry rub and then hitting it with the sauce after. And for that, you know, I'm using some cayenne, I'm using some chipotle so I can get a little smoke and heat, some chili powder, cumin, garlic powder, onion powder, and then I'm rubbing those wings down. Then I'm baking those off, and then I'm finishing them on the grill when I'm hitting them with a nice barbecue sauce that I've made, because you want to let those wings cook first and then hit them with the sauce at the very end so you're not burning your sauce, but you're getting that nice char on there, and it's all sticking and makes that gooey mess that you can just, you know, you should be using at least 10 napkins.
So, Cheryl, you talked about proteins earlier, and you've given us sort of the formula for a marinade. But what about rubs? What rubs do you love to use with what proteins? Can you put a rub on anything you grill?
So I'm pretty consistent with the rub, and the ingredients that were shared is what I use across the board. I mean, it's important to have that cayenne, that cumin. Those are good combinations. I like onion powder. There are pre-made rubs that you can get in the store if you don't want to follow a recipe, but it is important to rub and then cook because you want to season your food at each level. I know some people will just take chicken, they'll put it in a marinade, and then put it on the grill. I season my chicken, let it sit for a few hours, then I'll put it in a marinade. Like, I want that intense flavor at every level that I am handling the food.
So what about ambiance, the two of you? When you host, what is important other than what's on the grill?
I mean, you have to have music and tons of people. I mean, for me, like, if there's some great tunes going and there's a ton of family and friends there and the fire is going and I'm grilling, I'm set. Okay, maybe a drink in my hand. So, you know, that to me is, that screams summer, that screams fun. I'm actually planning a big barbecue at my house, which we're calling the Epic Post-Pandemic Barbecue of 2021, and we're shutting down the whole street because, wow, like, that's the kind of party I want, and I want that grill going. You know, I want to go through two or three propane tanks during the day.
Wow. And how about for you, Cheryl? What goes alongside what's on the grill to make a great barbecue?
So you would think that he and I were sitting together because he stole my thunder. You've got to have good music. You have to have people inside and outside. I love entertaining on my deck, on my grass, in my house. You know, some sort of cocktail has got to go along with it, you know, that complements the food. And just people getting together. He and I, wait a minute, when's the party?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm going to have to get your email and throw an invite out there.
Producer Jamie Bologna wants to know about grilling pizza. If you want to try to grill pizza, what do you have to keep in mind? What are the conditions for grilled pizza success?
We do grilled pizzas a lot for big events we do in the seaport. We're always using the grill for that. You can do it directly on the grates if you pre-bake your crust a bit. But, you know, for us, we use a product called the steel, the baking steel, which goes right on our grill. And we can get that up to, you know, 500, 600 degrees and really get that super hot. Because for me, that's the key to a good pizza is when you're sliding on your pizza dough, you want that leoparding on the bottom. You want that beautiful leopard crust on the bottom. And you don't want it to cook too long. You just want it to rise and you want the cheese to melt on top. So we're really looking for a lot of heat. I love using the steel. You can use a stone as well. I find the steel is much more effective than a stone because the stones crack very easily. If you're doing it directly on the grates, though, I mean, that's something you know, you want to do it 3/4 of the way in your oven. That way you can do it, you know, just dough onto the grates, but you could have a couple miscues that way. But if you want to make it really easy, do it partly in your oven, then finish your whole pizza on the grill and, you know, get some lump charcoal on there so you get the smoke, you get the fire, and you'll get that beautiful effect on it. It will be delicious.
All right, so Cheryl, Joe gave us a lot of good coaching there about what goes underneath the pizza. If you're going to grill a pizza, what's the best thing to put on top of it?
I'm a big fan of veggies and chicken some sort of way. So it could be little pieces of barbecue chicken or jerk chicken. But I like that as a protein. You could do other things, but that's my favorite and my go-to.
All right. So as we were preparing for this segment, producer Paris Alston threw down the challenge, which was to ask you guys how to make, pick one, an Impossible Burger, a Beyond, a Veggie, a Turkey Burger taste as good as an all-beef one on the grill. So I have thrown down. Who's going to accept the challenge?
To make a turkey burger as good as a beef burger? Is that the challenge?
Can you do it?
I've got a really good little tip. So
go for it.
My wife doesn't eat beef, and what I do is I take the turkey meat, and then I have like an Italian turkey sausage, and I grind that up and mix it in with the turkey meat, and you get this amazing flavor, and it holds together, and like people just can't figure out why it's so tasty. So it's a good way, instead of just adding spices.
Because you're putting pork in there.
No. It's a turkey sausage.
Oh, okay. I'm like, it's Joe, I think you're stepping out of the bounds of the challenge.
Yeah, here we go. So we're going to throw some beef and pork into the turkey burger. No. No, we're going to throw a turkey sausage and grind that up in the food processor. It's a good little just tip and really easy, and you can change the flavors up really, really, really simply.
All right. So actually, that sounds fabulous. Cheryl, how about you? Impossible, you know, a veggie burger of some kind. Can you make that as satisfying, at least, as a beef burger on a grill?
I think Impossible Burger is a good replication of a beef burger. The thing with Impossible Burgers is you have to infuse it with a lot of seasoning. So I like Montreal steak seasoning rubbed into the Impossible Burger. That's the best that I've tasted so far when it comes to a non-traditional burger using the steak, Montreal steak seasoning.
Now, I have to say, for the prime burger in our house is ground sirloin with a rub of Lawry's seasoned salt and Montreal steak spice. And then, you know, cooking that. So also, let's just talk about just got a little bit of time, Joe, quality of the protein. How important is that?
That's everything.
Can you make
it? I mean,
okay.
That's everything. I mean, quality is what counts. I mean, the best way for me cooking is very few ingredients, but quality ingredients. And, you know, for me, I'm not a big on like big, huge burgers. I like sliders. That's my jam. But doing a grind yourself, you know, we use a little brisket, chuck, you know, and grinding that and getting just top-notch beef. You want to taste the beef, and that's what the whole burger is about. So spend your money there, you know, and make some rolls yourself. They're super easy to make, and that's a really tasty treat.
Local chef and culinary instructor Joe Gatto, host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, and Cheryl Strotter, chef and owner of Soleil in Nubian Square, speaking with us back in May. This hour, conversations about food, particularly pandemic food, and the things we've explored during this most unusual couple of years. As we enter September, and yes, the end of summer, a new chill arrives in the air. Time to put up stores this fall for the coming winter. We want to revisit a conversation we had last September with Travis Grillo, the owner of Boston-based Grillo's Pickles, and Julia Hallman, lead buyer at Formaggio's Kitchen, where she teaches about canning, jamming, and pickles. And we began with why Travis Grillo just loves to pickle things.
For me, it was something that I didn't get a job at Nike, so it's kind of another creative way to, you know, do something that I didn't have a job and I wanted to make some money, so I rolled out the first pickle car ever in Boston and started selling two spears for a dollar on the street, and it took off until now, you know, it's a national brand. So It was just something creative, something different, and I use a lot of my design background into the pickling process to spread the word around Boston.
Travis, you may win the award for most surprising answer of the week with, I sell pickles because I didn't get a job at Nike. I love that. So, Julia, you moved to Boston from Oregon and missed gardening and preserving so much that you actually are making it work from a little apartment. Tell us about that transition here and getting started in the city.
Yeah, I grew up on a little farm in eastern Oregon where it was a family tradition to make blackberry jam every season at the end of summer. And then I went to school out at Tufts and realized that I missed all of that sort of homegrown, home-preserved food. And so starting actually even while I was a student, I started my own garden and started preserving as much as I could. And now I have a little bit more space, but still in Cambridge, space is pretty limited. So I've created a little pallet garden so that I can do vertical gardening and preserve as much of the harvest as I can to put up for the winter so that I'm enjoying all of the tomatoes and cherries and plums that I'm able to grow in the summertime throughout the winter.
I want to ask you both, what is your favorite thing that you have pickled or preserved in your own kitchen in, say, the last couple of weeks? Travis, you first.
For me, I've been experimenting with a lot of cabbage. And I've been, you know, not necessarily a kimchi, but more of a light vinegar salted brine. Just another way to preserve cabbage and use it in salads, use it on tacos. It's just another way to utilize the cabbage that most people think you just got to maybe boil. Or, you know, so for me, it's just another way to use it and add spices to the brine, which would be, you know, vinegar and salt and water, but then you could add in turmeric and things, the rosemary or flavors that you like specifically. And it's just a good way to, you know, experiment with is like using cabbages, things like that. And also
so would,
beets.
Would turmeric like and rosemary beets. Taste really good on like cabbage on a taco? That's one of the things that you said, Travis.
Yeah, look, I would use like a cilantro, you know, something a little bit more to the occasion, but it's all about what you like. You know, if you like heat, you can add hot peppers, jalapenos, things like that to spice up the pickling process and to make the vegetable to coordinate with whatever meal you're making.
How about you, Julia? What's your favorite thing you've preserved or pickled or jarred in some way in the last couple of weeks?
Sure. So I always try to experiment every year. One of my old standbys that I love is doing a melon jam. It's a pretty classic jam in Italy, and I had it on the shelves at Formaggio, and I thought, why can't I get this around here? Why don't I ever see it? And so I tried making it. And so over the years, I've been kind of experimenting a bit, fine-tuning the recipe. And basically, I wait until I find a melon that's just perfectly sweet, and then I just put that aside for canning. But then we also had our grapevine go absolutely crazy this year, and I, for the first time, pickled grape leaves because I've always had fond memories of making dolmas with my dad growing up. So I thought that, you know, I might as well keep it all in-house and preserve the grape leaves so that I can do that in the fall and winter when it gets a bit colder.
What kind of melon do you use in the melon jam?
So you can really use anything. For me, one of my favorites is canary melons, which are just bright yellow on the outside and almost a white flesh on the inside. But I've also had amazing results with just a super sweet cantaloupe.
So, Travis, why is this a great moment to either learn how to or step up your game on pickling and preserving, both in terms of the fall and this pandemic moment we're in where people are doing so much more in their own kitchens?
Yeah, I think it's a good way to, you know, A, pass some time, right? Pickling takes time. It takes a few hours. You got to clean your products. You got to prep things. So I think the time can be helpful, right, for the long days and the cold days that we have ahead. So something to keep you busy. But also if you have a family, it's a good way to bring the family together and everybody be interactive and have fun and have laughs. And then you can have competitions where each family member has a different pickle idea and then you try them in a couple weeks later. So you can just have a lot of fun around it. It's just another way I think that people can have fun with. It's just a great way to preserve things too through your garden so they're not going to waste. So you get a lot of benefits from pickling and spreads love. So it's just something that's all positive for me.
Sasha has a question. Sasha, you're on from Cambridge. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, yes. So I have tried a little bit of pickling and canning in the past, but I'm intimidated by all of the equipment that you're supposed to have, and my kitchen's really small, so I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for substitutes for the equipment, things that you might have around the house so you don't have to buy all new stuff and find a place to put it.
Great question, Sasha. Julia, I'll let you take this one first.
So that's actually a great question, and I have a lot of experience because I, at one point, lived in a 500-square-foot apartment in Harvard Square and still did a lot of canning. And one of the really important things for canning when you're doing a water bath is to make sure that the jars don't touch the bottom of the pot, because that helps to prevent breakage from the glass touching a really hot surface. So one hack that I did, because I didn't at that time really have space for a massive canning pot, with the sort of apparatus, sort of the canning holder that you put inside there, I just pulled up a kitchen towel and put it at the bottom of a stock pot. Basically anything that you use that's tall enough to give about 1 inch to 2 inches of headroom over that pint-sized jar. And it's a really good hack, so that really it's all materials that you already have. And one of my favorite tools to always have on hand for canning is a jar lifter, and that doesn't take up much space at all. And other than that, you really don't need any other of the specialized equipment to do some basic canning, like making jams or canned tomatoes and things, and pickles and things like that. That's my advice, is to just kind of work around those with the materials that you have. And then once you get more space, then you can buy the more specialized equipment when you do bigger batches.
So, Travis, I had a Grillo pickle with my lunch today in anticipation of the show, and I have never pickled anything before, but it was tasty. And if I now felt inspired, but as Julia was saying, don't have a lot of equipment and certainly not any skill, how could I start? What's maybe the first thing I could try at home?
Yeah, for me, you know, it's familiar as well, because I started in my apartment in Alston. So for me, I get the pain there. And I think that the best thing to do is to make sure you have, maybe for mine was an extra refrigerator. So I had an extra refrigerator so that way I could have some of my supplies. Now, there was a time I only had one refrigerator. So what did I do? I sacrificed what I ate, right? And I just had more pickles. So there's some sacrificing there. But as far as supplies and stuff, a lot of these things that you need for my type of pickling, which is a cold process, you can find right around in your own home. And if you don't have lids, you could use tin foil and an elastic band and put it in the back of your fridge and still enjoy them. So you could utilize any old containers that you have that other food has come in. So you can utilize those type of things that you already have to do the pickling process. And a lot of, for us, it's cold. So you'd have to have refrigeration to be able to mass produce your pickles if you wanted to do it over a long period of time.
I had a colleague tell me today about an experience that she had where some bottles blew up. So we all have those moments where maybe we tried something and it didn't go right. Julia, I was just being funny, but it is interesting that we do seem to see people kind of having hunkering down behavior. There is a social phenomenon going on, not only because we're closed in, but also because the future seems uncertain. Do you think there is a return to this sort of long tradition that's coming from that place?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it, too, as more of a return to normalcy for myself, because, you know, growing up in a very self-sufficient way where, you know, I hunted for my food, fished for my fish, and grew all the vegetables that we ate, you know, I think it's great to have people realize that the food chain isn't infallible and that we need to support more of our local producers and local farmers and also rely more on ourselves. So I think of it more as a positive, where people are starting to realize that they have a lot of the resources and tools around them. They've just never really been taught how to use them properly. And so now with this pandemic, people are giving the time, the knowledge, the information, and with the local farmers being really some of the only people who are continuing the supply chain during sort of the panic buying that happened in the beginning, they're now getting better access to these great local ingredients if they don't have room to grow their own food. So yeah, so I think if anything, it's a really, really great return to how important it is to kind of look a little bit closer to home for what's important with what you consume.
And Travis, in doing some reading on that subject, I saw, you know, articles about people preserving and canning even like meat, like poultry, et cetera. What are maybe some of the surprising things that we can either pickle or preserve, you know, this time of year?
I think something that's, you know, watermelon rinds and some of the waste that people use, even carrot shreds and things that people just throw away. Again, like what Julie said, it's like getting back to basics, and I think people are utilizing that. So, you know, instead of throwing things in the garbage, sometimes you could throw them in brine and salt and use them on a dish 4 days from now that has a great topping now. So, you know, like a watermelon rind, really good to pickle, and it tastes good, and you can make it sweet. You can add mint, fresh mint. So there's all these things like that that I think have a longevity if you can get it, you know, get it done.
I think I might give the last word to a call. We've got Russ on the line from Winchendon. Russ, go ahead.
I have a quick recipe for Thai-style namprik namplau, which is hot peppers and fish sauce. It's not very American, and it's not very pickled. You don't have to cook it. You just chop cayenne peppers or Thai dragons, eighth of an inch to quarter of an inch long, maybe mince some garlic, some shallots. I like a little bit of ground black pepper or powdered white pepper. Soak the whole thing in Southeast Asian fish sauce and cap it tightly because it smells. Americans don't like that smell.
Caller Russ from Winchendon there with the last word on pickling things. We spoke with callers and Travis Grillo of Grillo's Pickles and Julia Hallman, lead buyer at Formaggio's Kitchen, back in September 2020. This hour, our favorite conversations about food from the pandemic. We checked in on grilling as we celebrate the last long weekend of summer. We heard about pickling as we enter the fall. And now our last act, tasty treats for the coming colder months.
Today feels like the perfect day to be talking about cookies. Warm and cozy as opposed to freezing and icy.
That delightful voice is James Beard Award-winning cookbook author and New Englander Dory Greenspan, author of Dory's Cookies. We spoke with her and Radio Boston cookie superfan Chris Siderick in December of last year. And we began with why Dory thinks cookies are the perfect antidote to pandemic loneliness.
It's nice to have a variety, and it's so easy to have a variety with cookies. And even if we're not having cookie swaps and sharing our cookies face to face, cookies are a great present. They pack well, they ship, you can drop them at your neighbor's doorstep. And cookies, there's kind of a cookie for everyone. You can make the entire world happy with cookies.
And I will say cookies makes me feel as happy as the entire world. So that makes good sense. I'm going to go straight to the phones. Jessica in Cambridge actually has a cookie memory she wants to share. Jessica, go ahead.
Oh, good.
So this time of year really reminds me of my grandmother's chocolate crinkle recipe. And now that she's been gone for a few years, it's now my tradition to make the crinkles for my family. So this time of year definitely reminds me of her fudgy, delicious chocolate crinkles.
Those sound wonderful, Jessica.
Yeah, it's so lovely. And Jessica, what you just said makes me think about another reason why we all love cookies so much, but sweets in general. You know, sweets are something we make because we make them for love, because we don't really need them the way we need dinner. And they're such a nice way to keep family memories alive and to pass on traditions. And to pass on what made us happy as children, to be able to pass that on to our other family members and to share that with friends. It's a lovely thing to do. And crinkles are so good.
Well, you know, Jessica just talked about fudgy, chocolatey cookies. And Chris and I, or actually it was my best friend's daughter, she helped me with baking, and she baked the World Peace cookies. Chris, you baked them. And Dory, I think you had some World Peace cookie dough already at home, right?
That's right. And I now have a World Peace cookie in my hand. So
excellent.
We've all got them.
There's no better place to be than wherever you are with a World Peace cookie in your hand.
That's right. So, Dory, here's what we're going to do. Chris and I are going to taste our World Peace cookies while you tell our listeners a little bit about the cookie and the recipe. And then you're going to eat, and Chris and I are going to talk about the cookie baking experience. So, Dory, tell us about the World Peace cookie.
So the World Peace Cookie, the recipe was given to me over 20 years ago by my friend, the pastry chef, the Paris pastry chef, Pierre Aramé. And when he made this cookie, he had in mind the American chocolate chip cookie and the French sablé. Sablé means sandy in French, and so the French shortbread. And the cookie, you know, because you just made it, is very simple to make. It's just flour and brown sugar, some white sugar, chunks of chocolate, butter, of course, butter, 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 no eggs, chunks of chocolate, and some salt. And when Pierre gave me this recipe, the amount of salt in it and the fact that you could taste the salt, you'd finish the cookie and the flavor of the salt would linger and it would kind of urge you on to take the next bite or the next cookie. That was very unusual. Now we take it for granted that, you know, we sprinkle a little salt on top of a cookie or we add more than a pinch. But this was really new. And the cookie is made, you mix it as you would any cookie, and then you make the dough into logs and you either chill or freeze the log. And so this cookie, which I think is extraordinary, I hope you feel that way about it, is really a slice and bake cookie. And so oh, I love the sound of people laughing while they're eating cookies. The cookie has this interesting texture. It's both chewy and sandy. It's very, did I mention that it's made with cocoa? I might not have. It's got that deep, real chocolate flavor because of the cocoa, which is just chocolate, chocolate, chocolate. And then every once in a while, you get the bits of chocolate and the salt. And so every bite is like a different, it's a different proportion of cookie to chocolate chunk or chocolate chips. And so I find that as simple as the cookie is, it's always interesting. You're always ready for the next bite.
You take your next bite now, and Chris, we're going to let Dory enjoy the flavor. And I would got to tell you, I would fight my way across the room for one of these cookies. They're so good. Chris, you made them. So talk about, you know, Dory called it simple.
Yeah, I know. I was smiling at that word simple because I have to say, Dory, the way you write your recipes is wonderful for a person like me because I feel like every few lines you put in some reassurance in there. And this is definitely one of those recipes where you're like, don't worry if the dough looks like this or that. It's going to be delicious. Just keep going. And I really did find myself, the dough wasn't quite coming together. You have to form it into the logs. It was a little bit of work to get it to do that. As I'm slicing them up, I'm thinking, well, some of these aren't the prettiest, but man, are they tasty. And as you said, Dory, it's that those chunks of bittersweet chocolate just
Dory, back to you.
The dough is – it's never quite the same one time to the next, but it's always a delicious cookie. And so you just have to roll with it, really, and just keep mixing it until it comes together. But there's something that I do in this cookie that I do in all my chocolate chip cookies, and it's something that you can, you don't, even if you're not making a World Peace cookie, although I hope you will, you can use this. Instead of using chocolate chips, I use my favorite bar chocolate in cookies. So I chop the chocolate, and it means I'm getting my favorite chocolate. I'm getting a good quality chocolate, and I'm getting lots of uneven pieces. And so, Chris, when you said that intermittent, you know, bite in, you know, the chocolate is there here and there and not regularly, that's really a treat. And you can do that with any cookie that calls for chocolate chips.
You mentioned the recipe that the dough is very different if you try it fresh out of the oven when it's still warm or if you let it cool to room temperature. And being a thorough researcher, I made sure to try it both ways. And it is really interesting, the difference in texture.
And tomorrow, if you made these today or if you made them yesterday, and over the course of a couple of days, they get a little drier, but still delicious, just a little different.
So that's interesting. And Dory, because I noticed with the classic jammer that actually I felt they got moister over a few days because of the way the jam soaked into the cookie. And I want to talk about that recipe in a second. But one of the things that was on my mind with both of these recipes, Dory, is They require special ingredients, sometimes special equipment, maybe a 2-inch cookie cutter, lots and lots of butter. One recipe calls for a fine salt or sanding sugar. That's expensive and it's complicated. And we will have people who want to enjoy cookies this year, but who are facing some real hardship.
Absolutely.
They may have limited
yep.
space, ingredients. So are there ways to make them more affordable, easier to make, requiring fewer equipment, pieces of equipment? How do you address that?
Well, most everything that's made in a mixer can be made by hand and was for hundreds of years. So we start there. it's nice to have a stand mixer, but you don't need one. The salt, you can use regular table salt. It's always with cooking and with baking, you try and buy the best ingredients that you can afford. But in both cooking and baking, there's so much room for playing around, for doing, decorating a cookie doesn't have to be an expensive sprinkle or sanding sugar. It can be regular granulated sugar or a little bit of, if you have raw sugar. Or, see, people always say to me, you never decorate. The fact is that I would leave off most decorations on cookies, even at holiday time. I know this is probably heresy, but I find plain cookies beautiful. I find just the ingredients as they bake together make something lovely. So it doesn't have to be fancy and it doesn't have to be decorated. My mother didn't bake at all. Forget that. I have no recipes from my mother. But my grandmother was a baker, and she had a wooden spoon, a big bowl, and when she had to cut something out, she used a drinking glass. So, and she didn't have a rolling pin. She used a bottle. It's all possible. And it's fun. There's nothing, what could be more fun than solving the problem of I don't have or I can't, I can't find whatever, whatever it is, and finding a solution for it. And then what you bake is even more special.
So, Chris, you and I made Dory's classic jammer. Dory,
I got to say, these were my favorite, too.
Yeah. So I'm going to let Chris talk a little bit about the classic jammer while I take a bite, the baking process. And then your inspiration on this one is fascinating, Dory. So we'll talk about that in just a second. Chris, what was your baking experience like with the classic jammer?
This one was a little terrifying for me because you had two different...
Did you use the word terrifying?
I jokingly use the word terrifying. I mean, it's all fun. I
really
enjoyed the process.
I was scared too.
There are multiple elements. You're making a streusel dough and you're making a shortbread dough and kind of combining these things. And there were things I hadn't really done a ton of before. But again, your recipes kind of walk you right through the process and the way this thing comes together. I thought going into this, we knew we were going to make the world peace and the classic jammers. And I thought no doubt the world peace cookies were going to be my favorite. But the shortbread and the sweetness of the streusel and I use blackberry jam personally. So there's a nice kind of tart bite to it. Yeah. Oh, just unbelievably delicious. And I think you can kind of defend eating them for breakfast because it's almost like toast and jelly situation. So it's a win on all levels. I love this cookie. We're going to make this every year for the holidays from here on out.
Oh, so, this makes me so happy. So I was on your website and I saw the cookies and they're beautiful. Weren't you proud of yourself that you made those?
Oh, I have sent that picture to so many people.
Proud. But so mine. So here's the thing. I worked just as hard as Chris, Dory, but I didn't send the picture around because I felt like I let him cook a little too long. They're still delicious. But they weren't as beautiful as I wanted because my raspberry jam splurged out a little bit and I felt like they were a little dark.
Oh, okay. So I'm just going to explain the cookie and then I want to come back to your dark cookie. So the cookie is a shortbread. You make the dough, roll it out, and cut it. The cookie came about, I had a dream. I was in Paris. I dreamed about this cookie. I created it in my head in the middle of the night, woke up the following morning, made it, and loved it. Mm-hmm. So it's this vanilla shortbread cookie, and you bake it in a muffin pan. And the muffin pan keeps its shape, keeps the cookie shape beautifully, so that you don't have anything to do but to pop it into the pan, and the pan makes each one exactly the same size. So they look so professional. Then there's a dollop of jam in the center, and then there's streusel around it. So you, what you see is the circle of jam in the center and this bumpy, crunchy dough around the edges. And you get lots of different textures. So you get the crunch of the streusel, and you get the softness of the jam and that crumbly shortbread texture. And as you said, it does get a little softer because of the jam as time goes on. But so I am someone who really likes a well-baked cookie or a well-baked tart shell. I think that if you don't get enough color on what you're baking, you're not getting all the flavor that the ingredients
can give. There you go.
So I have a feeling I would love your cookie.
I want to get one more call in. We've got Esther on the line from Sudbury. Esther, do you have a short story for us?
Yes. When I was a child, I was baking something, and the instructions didn't say to cream the sugar and the butter before adding the eggs, so I tried to mix that all up, and it curdled. And I had to wake my dad up in the afternoon. He was a baker. He went to work at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I know if I threw something out, he would be upset. And he said, why didn't you cream the butter and the sugar first? And I said, it didn't say so in the book. And the way he fixed it was making another batch of cookies and creaming the butter and the sugar and then adding my curdled mixture into that and doubling the recipe. And I know people have made that mistake, and it was a real helpful thing for me to be able to tell them to repair.
Sure. Plus, you have bonus cookies.
That's right. That's a great cookie hack. Esther, thank you so much.
Oh, that's
so, Dory,
terrific. Thank you.
We are almost out of time, Dory. So, but I do want to ask you, is there one other recipe from the book that just is a cookie that gives you great joy this time of year?
It's a very simple cookie. It's called the Melody Cookie, and it's a chocolate cookie. Again, it's a rollout cookie. It's a cookie from my childhood. It's a crunchy cookie that you just put sugar on top of. And that cookie just, it just brings my entire childhood back to me.
James Beard Award-winning cookbook author and New Englander Dory Greenspan. She, along with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, joined us to talk cookies in December of 2020.